Hello and welcome to the Writers Festival of Belgium podcast on the page. Today we talk to writer and journalist Eleonora Balsano and podcaster Eleonora Balsano, who is one and the same and has a podcast called Chosen Tongue. She goes into deep dives on multilingualism, writing in other languages on that podcast, and it's really, they're really great interviews. If you haven't checked it out yet, do so. I highly recommend it. We talked to her about how she gets her thoughts on the page, how her involvement with a new writers community since last year, which has been developing, called the European Writers Salon, which is coming to Belgium in 2025. We're very happy to be helping them bring that to Belgium in any way we can. Also about the podcasting, and also about books, language, etc. Enjoy the conversation.
My name is Eleonora Balsano. I was born in Rome, and I came to Brussels when I was just 24 because I was very passionate about the European Union. It was very leitmotif of my school years, and it felt very natural. Also, it was a moment when in Brussels, everything was blooming. They were discussing a European constitution. It really felt like something huge was about to happen. And then we all know it didn't really, but you know, the spirit was there. And so I was a journalist back then. And I always thought I would like fiction more at some point, because what I did best as a journalist were portraits. So I was always interested in characters more than the news or facts. And then at some point I started writing fiction, and I decided to write it in English because I had been out of my home country for too long, and I felt disconnected from the culture, if not from the language. Language was fine, but I was not following the debate or, you know, the popular things anymore. And while I started writing in a second language, I realized it felt natural to me, but it elicited strange reactions in people. So, you know, I took so many workshops at the time because I like to have a structure. And very often there were people, very well-meaning and kind people, saying, "Oh, you write really well for a foreigner." And I knew it was, there's such a British thing to say. And, you know, I knew they were well-meaning. They were saying like, "Oh, wow, I didn't know that foreigners could write English anyway, at a fiction level." But I started to doubt myself, you know, and I started thinking, do I have the right to do this? And then my family and friends, so all the people that had read me in Italian, because I wrote in Italian for a decade as a journalist, were like, "But you wrote so well. Why are you doing this? What does it mean? Why are you hiding who you are?" I really got all sorts of comments. And it got me thinking, you know, because I didn't have an answer. I was just following my gut instinct. And so I started researching all the authors that had written in a second language. And of course, we all think of Nabokov or Joseph Conrad, but there were so many more, actually, and there are so many more. And I decided to talk to them, to all those I could reach and that had been having the same kind of thoughts, because I realized for the podcast that you can write in a second language and never think about it, or you can do it and just have a continuous conversation in your head about that. So those who have that kind of conversation going on are those who came on the podcast.
Tell us again what the podcast is called.
Yes, it's called Chosen Tongue.
And what, from when you were starting it to where you are now, which is roughly a year, if I'm not wrong. Well, you tell us.
It's a year. It's a little bit over a year. It aired October 23.
All right. What do you think? What have you found? How has it changed what you think about portraits? Has it just like reinforced what you thought about portraits or, you know, telling the story of one person?
I think it's great. So yeah. I like to keep it very laid back. So if it was a TV show, we would be having coffee sitting on the floor probably. And the idea is just, you know, I feel weird about writing in a second language. Do you too? Or how did you overcome that feeling? And that's the main question I ask.
Right.
And I think what comes out is very, very interesting. So a lot of people who write in a second language live in a condition of displacement. Mm-hmm. And displacement is something that interests me very much, because it can happen because of traumatic events. So some people fled wars or other kinds of international crises, or immigrated, or are children of immigrants. That's especially in the US, it's very frequent. But some people were displaced just because they went somewhere else to university and stayed and married someone. And it doesn't make the displacement less profound. Mm-hmm. It makes it easier as life, basically conditions of living, of course, if you leave because you're going to university and not because you're fleeing a war. But intimately, your displacement is just the same. And you question every day, where do you belong? And you don't belong anywhere. That's the thing in the end. Mm. So one thing that was very beautiful that came out in the podcast when I interviewed Hisham Matar is that he said, you know, there is a language that it's above all the other languages, and it's the language of humanity. Mm. And so when you write and you connect on a human level, it goes beyond the mother tongue, the chosen tongue, the whatever tongue.
There's this one author, I always forget her name. You probably know her, maybe you've even interviewed her, where it's that I think she's American, she started writing in Italian, and there's all these articles about why.
The Jhumpa Lahiri.
Voila.
So she's a Bengali American, and she's a professor at Princeton, and she actually, I think, took Italian classes at college because she liked Italian. And then at some point when she was already well known, famous, I think she already won a Pulitzer in the US, she decided to move to Rome, where she lived for a few years, and she started writing and publishing in Italian. She wrote a whole book about that experience, and she's very vocal about it. You know, when I came to your festival, I mentioned this article by the that was on the FT a few years ago that was called Global Doesn't Cut It Anymore. And it described this phenomenon of known English speakers suddenly speaking very good English because of social media, YouTube, and kids being exposed very, very young. And the article said, well, now, you know, these people speak like native speakers or very close to native, and some start writing in English to reach a bigger market. And so the article was saying that at some point in the coming years, every author will work on two different plans. So one plan in his native tongue, in his home country, and then on the international plan, and everything there happens in English. And I don't think that all writers will do that, but some of that will, certainly. And I don't think it's monolingual, but it makes me think of at some point in the Roman Empire, Latin was the common language. But a lot of things were going on in every region in the local language. And even, you know, writers and poets and politicians, they operated in two different languages at all times. So I think that known native speakers bring something to the language, bring different flavors. I think that the language will evolve because of that. So I can't say where we will be in 50 years' time, but I think we will be having a global conversation in English for sure.
So tell me, what are you excited about in 2025? What are you seeing in terms of books, in terms of your personal stuff, in terms of maybe what's happening in Brussels, but maybe what's happening somewhere else? What are you thinking was?
Well, I'm very excited about this initiative I'm a part of, the European Writer Salon, that was launched a year ago. It came from a tweet by Deborah Zafer, that's an English writer. And, you know, she wondered, there was AWP going on in the US, the big literary conference there. And she said, well, maybe we should do something like that in Europe. And that tweet went viral, and very, very quickly. So I joined her, and other people joined, and we created the whole thing. And so it's been really a fantastic ride. And so our first big event, it will be in September 25, from 12 to 14th in Brussels. And we will have a Friday with others, and then workshops, and then talks with others. And British author Kate DeWall is coming, which is very, very exciting. Mm-hmm. And two more others will come. We're negotiating with them, so I can't tell the names yet. So that's something I'm really excited about, because we realize there is, especially after COVID, I think, there is a need for community. And writing is so solitary, and people like to know they have a place they can go where they will find people like them, and they can hang out and inspire each other and just walk out of there with their mental batteries recharged. So the podcast goes on. I'm preparing a fourth season. I'm also working on a novel. So yeah, lots of stuff to be excited about.
No, amazing, amazing. And I have to say massive congratulations to you guys for launching the European Writers Salon. It was brilliant. There was a day of workshops that we had towards the end of, a couple of days. You had a whole weekend, no? It was the end of October.
Yeah, we did a pilot event to check out, you know, the venue, the vibes, and it was a great success. I think the feedback we received was really good.
And then, because this is the idea is that it would move different countries, isn't it?
Yes, it's a traveling salon.
Yeah, good.
So every year is in a different country, and now we've started after Brussels. We did a pop-up event in London, and there are more in the fall and next year, but I can't tell the details yet.
Tell us a bit, if you don't mind, about because this is for writers as well, about your writing and how do you write? If you don't mind, you're one of those people with a daily program, or you're one of those people where it's like inspiration has to hit and could be anywhere, or?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that writing is mainly comes from the unconscious. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to, I mean, what I do is that I sit down every day and I try to get 2 or 3 hours every day. And unfortunately, it doesn't mean I always write during those 2 or 3 hours. Sometimes I just stare at the blank page. Sometimes I get up and make myself 10 coffees. And sometimes, you know, I force myself to write. And normally, after the first few lines that can be really bad, something happens and you start having images and things from your unconscious that just need to be on the page. And the only thing I'm very strict about is that I don't look at what I've written until a few days have passed. Because every time, you know, just after writing, I feel that whatever I wrote was bad. Always because, you know, I think that happens to many writers. I mentally compare what I had, what it sounded like in my head to what's on the page, and they're completely different. Yeah. But usually, if I go back to it 3-4 days later, I realize that it was not that bad, and what didn't work can be fixed anyway. So I think that the only rule I stick by is sit down every day for as much time as you have and don't edit immediately, just wait. A habit, I think, needs time to become one. And it's just when they tell you that you should walk, I don't know, 5,000, 10,000 steps a day. You know, it's not easy to do that, but little by little you get there. And once you get there, it's easier to maintain it.
Mm. Have you ever had like a fully formed idea, or is it snippets of
scenes, you mean?
Scenes or images or something that come in, like David Lynch just passed away recently. Yeah. He's one of my favorites ever.
He's incredible.
And I keep seeing this quote of his around that it's like ideas come, it's like fishing. Like you have to stay there and wait for the fish to come, and you collect all these ideas and images that come to you.
Absolutely. And an advice that a writer friend gave me many years ago, and it works sometimes, he said, so one way to prevent writer's block, and, you know, some people say that's not really a thing, but whoever feels blocked, he said, just take a book from one of your favorite authors and start copying one page. Mm-hmm. And when you're done, you just keep writing. And at some point, something will emerge and you will have, the problem of writing the first word will be gone because you're writing someone else's word. And mm-hmm. then you get an entry point into your own subconscious. I think sometimes it works.
What do you remember some of the first books that you loved, maybe as a kid, and then maybe like a favorite book from older?
So I read a lot as a child, and I think the first books I read very, very young were entirely YA. And I loved The Neverending Story. Mm. I think that was the first book that completely captured me, and I read it many times. I was very obsessed as a book. So I watched the film after. I think I read the book when I was six. It was probably the first novel I read.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated. And I rewatched the film as an adult. And of course, I was much less impressed. Mm-hmm. But what was really nice in that book for those who are our age and read it is that it was written in two different colors. So there was one part that was in red, and it was what was happening in real life. And one part was in green, and it was what was happening in the fantasy world. It really, you know, touched me as a child, because as many, you know, artsy or literary kids, I was convinced that there was a world beyond my real life and the things I was doing, and there was a world in my head. And so seeing that someone else thought like that was very consoling in a way. And then I think that through my early teens, I read the whole production of Agatha Christie. That was really my thing.
Yeah.
And I loved them. I loved them all. And I haven't read them since, but I just binge read them. And maybe a book that really impressed me when I was a little bit older, I think I read it in school, so I must have been 16 or 17. And I've been thinking about it recently, because we hear a lot about the author, because this year is 100 years since his death. And the book in English is translated as The Child of Pleasure by Gabriele D'Annunzio. So he is an Italian poet from the late 19th century, early 20th century. He was very much involved in politics as well. And that's why we're talking about him a lot recently. Hmm. And it's a beautiful book. It's very lyrical. He was a better poet than he was a novelist. And it's a story of this man in Rome in 1889, in love with a woman and leading a very beautiful aesthetically life, but also very dissolute. And it's an interesting book. It made on me a great impression, because it was very aesthetically pleasing. It was beautiful language, beautiful words, and the whole story was very glamorous.
Have you ever written poetry?
No, that's my biggest regret, because I love reading poetry. I read loads of poetry. There's always one poetry book by my bed, but I feel very blocked. Because I have this feeling that there are rules in poetry and I don't really know them. And, you know, I always say I want to take a workshop.
Right.
But I should just try without the workshop. But I haven't yet. But some translingual authors I interviewed say they started with poetry because they thought it was easier. So, yeah, you know, maybe at some point I will try.
But you do write short stories. I read one of your short stories last week, which was really beautiful, about a golden box.
The Past Life Box. I think that's how it's called. I wrote it 3 years ago, so it's a little bit blurred in my mind. Yeah. But yeah, it's I used to have those kind of boxes. So I think I wrote it around Christmas, and I probably had been at my parents where all of these mementos are stored. And I probably went into one of the boxes with little souvenirs of a life I don't have anymore. And so the woman in the story at some point decides she doesn't need that box anymore, and she and she destroys it.
Mm-hmm. No, it was beautiful. It was very simple, but it was a whole beautiful world. It was very...
Thank you.
Immediate. No worries. But Eleanor, remind me, I should have looked this up, but you've written other books, or this will be your first book?
Will be hopefully my first published book.
Okay.
So I wrote another novel in 2018 that didn't sell on submission, which was a very big sorrow at the time, and now I've overcome it, but it took a few years. And apparently it happens very often that a book, you know, you find the agent, everything looks great, and then it goes out and doesn't sell. But we withdrew it from submission quite early. So I think it got like 25 rejections. And then I decided that I wanted just to take it back. And I don't know if that book will ever see the light of the day. But after that, I started writing short fiction, so flash and short stories, and was great for mental recovery.
Yeah, which you've gotten published many times. I mean, I've seen...
I had a few things out.
Definitely. So that experience is a painful experience. It's not something where you're like, no, I'm going to get it and make it and sell it myself.
It was very painful.
It was very painful.
No, I never wanted to self-publish. Right. And, you know, I admire those who do, but I think that there is so much work that goes with self-publishing in terms of marketing, promotion, and I'm simply not good at that. Mm-hmm. And also I think that I wanted a validation of traditional publishing. I never wanted to self-publish, and I don't know, I think it was very painful. It was a particular book because it was very political, and maybe the right moment had just passed me by. Maybe 6 months earlier it would have been an easier sell, but it's okay, you know. It's it paralyzed me for a year and a half. And then I started writing Flash, and I regained confidence. And so I tried to write another novel, and I still loved the idea, but in the end I abandoned it. And now this one I feel very good about.
Strongly,
and so we'll see.
Yeah. Is it still painful, or is it a lesson learned, and et cetera? Or it's still very painful to think about that book?
It's less painful than it was in the beginning. But yeah,
How long did you take to write it? Like, was it a very long investment?
No, it didn't take long. So that's why I'm mad at myself.
You have to spend 10 years on something.
No, I'm taking so much longer now to write than I did before. Before being traumatized, I was like, you know, because you're a journalist too, and we are used to write in a very short time, a lot of stuff. So I wrote it in 6 months. I had a draft, and then I edited for another 3-4 months. And it was a decent draft in a year. Mm-hmm. Within a year, it was ready to go out. So it didn't take too long, but you know, rejection is something that you have to get used to. And now I am, and I think short fiction did that for me, because the turnaround with short fiction is very fast. You send a story out, and in a few weeks or months, you get a no or a yes. And after a while, the first no's are hard to stomach, and then you get used. It's just part of the game.
Now
I feel much better about it. But of course, the thing with novels is that they take a long time to write. And so you feel like, okay, you know, I spent a year and a half on a project, and then it's a no. But, you know, it's all experience.
Is there a favorite of one of the short fictions, or have they been like in the moment? And is there one that took longer? Is there one that came from a different place? Or have they been kind of similar? You've been inspired by, I don't know, life events or a prompt or something that's...
Oh, I think there's all of them contain some life events, probably in some form. You know, as I told you, I write very fast, but I take a very long time to edit. So there is one story that I really like, and it took me forever to place it, and it came out on Flash Boulevard a few months ago. It's called The Crystal Gondola. So that story existed under so many shapes. It was a long short story, then it became a micro, Then it became a flash, and in the end, it became a short, short story. So I think it's just 1,000 words or something. But it took a long time to place, and it's very dear to me because it's set in Venice. I have a couple of stories set in Venice, and probably more to come because I love the city. And it was a story of a marriage collapsing. That's one of my themes as well, because I'm interested in relationships. And a woman swimming in the canal, you know, once it's done.
That sounds amazing. Now I have to find it and read it. Yeah. But Venice, yeah. What's backdrops? Do you find Belgium interesting as a backdrop? Do you write stories about Brussels or not yet?
Not yet. That's very interesting.
Or not as a general priority?
You know, it's very interesting. I never wrote about Belgium. It doesn't. Maybe I should, because it, you know, it's where I live, where I've been living for 20 years. So I should actually. But it never came. It's a very, you know, it's a strange place, Brussels. I don't know how you feel about that, because it's like it's somewhere and it's nowhere at the same time, and it's not very defined as a place, because you go from one neighborhood to the other and you're in different countries. So I realize I've written some American stories, quite a lot of Italian stories. I know I don't have Belgian stories, but I should.
What's the American stories?
I have some stories that are set in America, because I lived there two different times, two different times in my life. But yeah, I think I have a couple of stories set in New York.
You lived in New York?
I lived in New York two different moments in my life. So one, it was pre-9/11, which was a very different New York. And the second time we moved as a family 3 weeks before COVID. Can you imagine the timing? And that went quite bad. But the first one, I was a student. I was finishing university and I was doing research for a thesis. It was great the first time. The city is an incredible backdrop of setting for films, for literature. It's an incredible city. Now, if I have to be really honest, I think that it completely changed after 9/11. I think that there was a form of extreme joy before that disappeared. So I think the wound is still there. Especially there is a different attitude towards foreigners in America in general.
Right.
So, and I understand, you know, it's a huge trauma and it will take some time to pass if it ever passes. But the first time I went to New York, I was 13 and I was with my parents. I was very excited, of course, because I'd only seen it in films. And I remember when we arrived at the border, there was this officer that stood up, and I was a kid, and he said, "Welcome to America, young lady." And it was so joyful, you know, and that's completely disappeared. So now when you get at the border, they're like, "Who are you? Where did you go? Who are you doing? Who do you know?" And it's always
when are you leaving?
Yeah. And it's always very suspicious, you know, like, are you a threat or not? I understand. So that's changed. So I still love the city. I haven't been since we left during COVID, and I hope to go next year or something. But that joy, that just pure undiluted joy, and you know, that sort of blossoming thing, I think a bit of that is lost.
And when you were there, so during COVID, so you stayed there during COVID, you mean?
Yeah.
Right. So you were already writing, or at least you had a...
My book was out on submission.
There or somewhere.
Yeah. Okay. It was on submission in UK. It didn't go in the US. So it was a British/European book. So yeah, it went out on submission while I was in New York.
Okay, so you definitely got the feel of publishing, writing. You still were writing, or you were just thinking about the submission? So you didn't...
No, I was still writing. It's when I started looking into Flash, and I remember there were a few literary reviews where I lived, and you know, I was thinking, oh, I should submit there and everything, and then I left. But you know, I still submit to those two literary reviews, because I don't know, I have this sort of nostalgic feeling.
Is there anywhere in Europe that has that feeling of publishing or where we can compare it or not really. And that's why we need things like the Writers Salon or the Writers Festival or et cetera. Because there maybe London.
London, but then, you know, post-Brexit London, London will stay London. It's so international. Yeah. But I think that it also stays very British. So I think that, yes, it's important to connect writers throughout Europe. Because, you know, the limit in Europe is there are different languages and different states. But that's really, you know, politics just evolves more slowly than the actual life, because there already is a European life going on. And, you know, since low-cost flights and people doing their Erasmuses or programs or intermarrying or just traveling and having friends all over. So there is already a European life. Mm. It's just that there isn't a different kind of unity yet.
Yeah. Eleonora, you said before you weren't really as connected to Italy as before, like in one of the, when you were, have you had like the chance to see what the publishing, like, do you kind of have an impression of what the publishing world's like in Italy?
I don't know. I don't know it very well. I don't have the impression Italians are big readers, certainly not as much as the French or the British. There is a lot of stuff in translation, so I think they buy a lot from abroad. For local things, I follow on social media a lot of, you know, big publishers, so I'm aware of what's being published.
Sure.
I feel a little bit removed from that. So it's a different conversation that I haven't been following for too long, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
Little things, and it's the fact of putting poems into public transport or things like that, or just, you know, giving money to the arts. I think it's so important and it says so much about the country. Yeah. And in Italy, there is not that culture. I mean, everything that's public is always a little bit tricky, because as a young country that was occupied by foreign powers until 1860, there's never been a feeling that the state would provide for us. That's completely lacking in Italy. So sometimes you have private initiatives and things, but they're not the kind of funds that you will find in France or in the UK or in Germany. Yeah. It's always been like that in Italy. I mean, everything that's public property is not really, there's not a feeling that what's public belongs to me as well, that it belongs to a community. So I think it's cultural, and people are very individualistic, which sometimes is great because that leads to faster innovation. But it's a shame also because, you know, the French invest enormously in their language, which really is one of their monuments. Yeah. And Italians don't. So they don't attach to it that much importance. And it's a shame. I remember a teacher telling me when I was in middle school, so a very long time ago, she was a linguist, and she said that Italian as a language was bound to disappear in 200 years. So I won't be there, but yeah.
Right. That's interesting. What are you reading now? Are you reading anything now? Or are you just revisiting Gabriele? What was his surname?
D'Annunzio. Actually, you know, you can't see my desk, but it's a mess of books.
I don't want to see my desk because I think it would be. Of course, yes.
I'm finishing this. I'm almost done.
It's part of your full circle book club.
Yes.
Tell us a bit about the book club. So you run the book club that is part of Full Circle, which is this fantastic building in Excel, where we had the European Writers Salon pilot.
Yeah,
and from what I understand, it's a brilliant conversation over there with you guys. I haven't managed to get there. But
you will. Listen, it's great. So Full Circle is it's a members club that it started. These two British ladies started it over 10 years ago already. Yeah. And they were organizing talks by, you know, economists, philosophers, linguists, whatever, sociologists, people from all over the world and huge names. They would come and talk about themes, and there would be Q&A session. It's still very lively. And then they built this incredible building in Excel. that used to be the seat of a radio. And so, and they redecorated it in mid-century style. It's very beautiful, very well done. And they have a theater at the back. So it's a nice place to do things in. And so during COVID has been a little bit of a, you know, big moment in my life because a lot of things changed after that. I was in a book club with a few friends, but you know how it is when you do things with your friends that after a while people want to hang out, have wine, have a good time, not really talk about books. And I really wanted to talk about books. And so I was a member of Full Circle, and I used to go to the conferences. So I went to see them, and I say, you know, what about a book club? Do you have space for that? And they say, well, okay, let's give it a try. And first one we did was a month before the second lockdown, and only one person came. So, you know, it was very tiny. And then when the second lockdown was over, we resumed it, and it slowly grew. And for me, it's such a joy now because now it's been over three years, almost 4 years that I've been doing it. And now there are 10, 12, you know, loyal people that always show up. And sometimes there is some book for, you know, an unpredictable reason that draws in 25 people.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. No, but the books that you're choosing, I mean, if, even though I haven't managed to get there, every time I do see which book it is, I go and rent, go and borrow it from a library or some, you know, a couple of times I've bought, but mostly I borrow, and they are fantastic books. And then usually I don't have time to finish them. And I'm like, that book, because Eleonora was right. This is amazing. This is so good. No, but the choices are just impeccable. And what when I asked you what you're reading, you held up Orbital by, what's the author's name again?
Samantha Harvey.
Right, which will be the next one. And obviously one Pulitzer. What prize did she win?
The Booker Prize.
The Booker Prize, of course. This year's Booker Prize. Last year's Booker Prize. How many books do you read a year? What do you think? What is this? Is this conversation real, or is it just a matter of willpower that people can't finish a book anymore and people aren't paying attention?
I think it's really hard to finish books. That's absolutely true. And I was very strict in the past, like, you know, even if I don't like it, I'm going to finish it. And now I don't, because there are too many books and too little time. Yeah. So if I'm not into it after 100 pages, I will give it up.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
now you're doing one a month, right? The book club once a month.
Before I read one book at a time. Now I read multiple books.
Right.
And, you know, there is always one night that I read poetry. I really love poetry, and I keep rereading the same things over and over again. And then, you know, I read the books for the book club, and whatever catches my attention or that I see reviewed or the story speaks to me.
And audiobooks are not so
audiobooks
much.
As well. So no, I had a phase, I think, during lockdown, because I was walking my dog a lot, because as you know, it was one of the few things we could do. Yeah. I listened to many, many audiobooks. Now a little bit less, maybe because I'm in a need
not
for music.
Not walking as much, yeah.
Yeah, and also sometimes I need music more than words, because I feel overwhelmed if I'm reading and I'm listening to readings. I love audiobooks, and some books are better than others to listen to. I don't think all the books are good listened to, but some are really great.
The poetry is any particular poet?
I love many poets. Okay. I have a special attachment to Kim Adonizio. She's a contemporary American poet. She writes amazing poetry books about women, about relationships. She's very honest, very raw, very, I mean, she really gets under my skin completely.
That was Eleonora Balsano, writer, short story writer, flash fiction writer, podcaster and journalist. I'm Alia Papagiorgiou, and this is the On the Page podcast. We're really happy to have you here. If you have any ideas or thoughts you'd like to share, please feel free to at info@writefest.be, or our website is writefest.be. Also, This show is produced by Paul McNally, and the dulcet tones of Craig Winnicker's guitar are what introduces me this podcast and is weaved throughout it. Take care and keep writing.